Blog Talk Radio.
Good afternoon and welcome to Spotlight on Youth. My name is Lauren Litton and I am the host of the show. Spotlight on Youth is dedicated to social and legal trends impacting the rights and well-being of children across the country. It is a project of the Children's Law Center, Inc., a not-for-profit children's rights legal services organization. The show is being streamed live over the Internet and will be available on demand after its conclusion. We encourage you to participate by asking our guests questions live on air by dialing 347-994-1149. That number again is 347-994-1149. Then you're going to press the number 1 on your telephone keypad to indicate you have a question, and you'll be placed in a queue to be on the air. Also, feel free to log into the chat room and pose a question there. This May will mark 4 years since the state of Ohio entered into a stipulation for injunctive relief or settlement in a federal class action based on the unconstitutional conditions of confinement that youth were subjected to when placed in the care and custody of the Ohio Department of Youth Services, which we'll refer to as DYS. Ohio has garnered attention due to this settlement as it's sweeping, forward-thinking, and built upon a collaborative model. The stipulation is 90 pages long and is framed by guiding principles as to lay a foundation and assist in its implementation. The priorities outlined focus on correcting the conditions that led to the lawsuit's filing, such as the misuse of force and isolation, the absence of mental health and other medical care, deficiencies in education and programming, offering training and support for DYS personnel, and creating a fair and suitable grievance and release process. But it goes beyond the conditions of confinement, looking to create a comprehensive continuum of care through a regionalized delivery system, and in many ways asks that the state and its partners examine how to prevent youth from entering the system, and when they do, enhance their intervention in order to increase their chances of treatment and rehabilitation. The case we're talking about was originally filed and called SHB Stickrath. It is now SHB Reed, as Harvey Reed was appointed the new director of DYS in March 2011. The state's compliance with the stipulation is monitored by a team of nationally recognized experts who possess specific subject matter expertise and conduct regular site visits to the facilities. Will Harrell, who heads the monitoring team, joins us today. He was appointed as lead monitor in December 2010 by Federal District Court Judge Marbley. Will also works with the Annie E. Casey Foundation in helping implement the Juvenile Detention Alternatives Initiative in Texas, Louisiana, and Mississippi. He has extensive experience in juvenile justice and conditions of confinement and has been a reformer of criminal and juvenile justice systems in 6 states and 5 countries. He has held federal and state appointment positions and has represented organizations such as the American Civil Liberties Union, the Southern Poverty Law Center, and the League of United Latin American Citizens and the National Association for the Advancement of Colored People. He has taught at several universities, including American, Texas State, and the Catholic University of Ecuador in Quito. Will is a resident of New Orleans. He holds a bachelor's in history from the University of Texas and a Juris Doctor and a master's of law from the American University. Will, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me, and thanks for that splendid introduction.
Well, we have so much to talk about today. A lot has happened in 4 years, and one example of many is that at the time of the settlement was entered into, there were 8 state-operated correctional facilities, and Ohio has now reduced that number to 4. And while there's progress, there's also a lot more to be done. So I'm not really sure where to start with all this, but maybe before we turn to the state of the settlement, you can share with our listeners what one's journey is to becoming a lead monitor. Maybe how did you become interested in social justice and youth issues?
You covered it pretty well in your introduction. I mean, I've done criminal justice work for a long time, since even before law school, and about 16 years since law school, and it's just always been a passion of me. I mean, the core of society's ills are represented in the way that we treat our most vulnerable, and that's even magnified when you put people behind bars and under the complete control of the state. That's just been always a philosophical and moral question that I've been drawn to intellectually and emotionally. And for years I was focused on, you know, traditional criminal justice issues, you know, anything, everywhere from police accountability to drug policy to, you know, conditions of confinement in adult and juvenile facilities. And over time I realized that, you know, a lot of the problems that I had been confronting as a lawyer or as a policy advocate working within legislative structures or as an executive branch official, a lot of the problems that I was trying to address or reform in the adult system could be avoided if we got it right on the very front end, and that being where people enter the criminal justice system from the beginning, and that in many cases are juveniles. If we can do the right thing by way of how we address juvenile delinquency through prevention and treatment once a kid has entered the system, then we can avoid some of the problems that we will deal with inevitably down the road when those individuals get into the adult criminal justice system. So I've refined my focus over the years on juveniles.
I see. So I'm guessing you probably get some blank stares, and when you say to people, oh, I'm serving as a monitor, a lead monitor in this case in Ohio, what is a role of a monitor, and how does your work here in Ohio maybe compare to other lead monitor roles in other cases?
Yeah, you know, it's been it's a new experience for me. I have worked in the juvenile justice arena in a lot of capacities. As I mentioned, you know, as a lawyer with the American Civil Liberties Union and the Southern Poverty Law Center, but also as a the state official appointed by Governor Rick Perry in Texas to monitor the Texas Youth Commission, which is the equivalent of the Department of Youth Services in Ohio. This role is one that is in the judicial branch of government. As you mentioned, there was a settlement agreement or a stipulation entered into by the parties, the state of Ohio, Department of Youth Services, and the plaintiff's attorneys in the SH versus Stickrath case. And part of the stipulation was to create a monitor who would be recommended or nominated by the parties and chosen by Federal District Court Judge Algernon Marbley, who is the judge in this case. The monitor, as it's laid out in the stipulation, you know, has access to records, data, the facilities, and can bring to the table a team of subject matter experts, which has been the case over the, you know, the years as this case has developed. So I essentially coordinate a team of subject matter experts. It's a fairly enormous team compared to most, but the difference between this case and almost any other case in this field right now is it addresses every aspect of juvenile corrections. Many cases will focus on one aspect, such as mental health, or another aspect, such as safety of youth in the facilities. But this case, to the credit of the state of Ohio, addresses every single component of the system. When Mr. Stickrath sat down with the plaintiffs and Mr. Stickrath's staff, you know, they essentially agreed that they wanted to come to the table and agree with the plaintiffs and set a goal to really truly become an excellent system. And I can say to you honestly that if and when the Department of Youth Services achieves compliance with all components of this stipulation, it will be the national model in juvenile justice. I'm convinced of that. I believe that Department of Youth Services has not only the will to get there, but the capability to do it. You know, I'm very impressed with the leadership of the agency and with most of the staff in the field. It's truly an agency committed to reform that has been working very hard, fast and furious, for more than 4 years to achieve the goals that are laid out in the SH versus Dickrath or SH versus Reed stipulated agreement. My role as the monitor is to bring these experts in to evaluate the compliance of the agency with the agreed stipulation. But what's fairly unique about the stipulation itself is that it lays out clearly that the role is to be not just one to find fault, but one to help the agency in achieving compliance. It essentially instructs our team to have an approach that's more collaborative and coaching rather than one that's just a gotcha model. It does not, support the model of drive-by site visits and site visit reports where you just point out mistakes. Rather, it provides that we identify compliance but also make recommendations and assist the agency and to achieving compliance, and that's the model that I think can work, and that's the one that we've been abiding by at least in the year that I've been on board.
Great, and maybe just to give the listeners some background, you mentioned sort of the massive undertaking of this, and that's why you also have the breadth of expertise on the monitoring team. Maybe you can talk about the different areas that you're monitoring, and then we can turn to you, because you recently did file a report and a supplemental one, and we want to hear about sort of the summary of your findings.
Well, we go to each facility and evaluate compliance on a facility-based level, but we also evaluate compliance on a systemic basis. But the stipulation addresses every aspect, from the mental health of treatment of youth and behavioral health, medical health, dental health, use of force, safety, staffing, training. It's really the gamut. And there's a subject matter expert on my team. I think there's a total of 11 plus two who look at specifically the mental health issue, one from a psychological perspective and one from a psychiatric perspective. But we have seen, I came in only a year ago, and we're entering the fourth year of the stipulation and the monitoring process. And just in the year that I've been here, I've seen tremendous improvement. And that process had begun before I got here, and I think that again represents part, in large part the genuine commitment on the part of the Department of Youth Services and doing what's right by these kids, but also striving to become what will be a national model. The annual report that you've referred to is the third annual report. It covers up to December 30th of 2011. In that, we've clearly identified 25% of the stipulated agreement as have been complied with. The agency has reached compliance. I can tell you that here we are about at the end of February, and that's already old news. I mean, I think we can say that at least two or three more stipulated paragraphs, the agency has now come into compliance with. I mean, we're on track. The agency is on track. The stipulation says that the agency shall comply with all of these provisions within 5 years. I think that's going to happen. And I'll tell you, frankly, if it doesn't happen, I view that as, representative of a failure of the monitoring team as much as it is of the Department of Youth Services, and maybe we'll get to this later, but I think one of the issues are some of the problems that the agency is having in terms of reaching compliance are problems not of their making. And we can talk about that in a minute, because there's things that other agencies really need to take on, and certainly things that the state legislature need to take on. But, you know, again, the agency is at right now, and I'd say more than a 25% compliance. And a lot of the areas that remain, you know, things are in process. You know, there's new policies that, you know, need to be trained, need to be fully implemented. But in systemic reform, people have to remember, you know, change just doesn't happen. You know, there's, you know, it's one thing to acknowledge a problem, write a new policy, but to implement a new policy takes a while. It takes, you know, not only good training and management, but it involves a culture shift. And you got to remember, you know, certain many staff for years, in some cases, you know, decades, were accustomed to a certain approach that was not unique to Ohio. This stipulation represents the greatest, the current modern thinking on juvenile justice, and it takes a while for that to set in. I've seen this in massive reform efforts in other states, and it's not unique to Ohio. So it takes some time for staff to get up to speed and get with the program, but I have no question that it's going to happen in Ohio.
Well, I mean, and I know the state has taken a huge risk on agreeing to all this, and it's being supported in many ways with allies in the state. But I would like to get to some of the specifics of the annual report to give people an idea of what we're talking about. So it sounds like...
I appreciate you doing that. I mean, it's a 200-plus paragraph stipulation, because I have no idea where we should begin. So, if you want to ask specific questions.
Oh, I want to ask specific. Well,
yeah.
I don't know if you want to share a few of the things that stand out. First, that where the state has been successful. I mean, I mentioned the reduction in population, which had to do with, you know, closing down some of the facilities, but other things that have led to that too. So I don't know if you want to talk about that other areas, and then we can turn to some of the challenges, as you're saying, because it's such a large endeavor. But I really want to know what the priorities are for moving forward and what things may still exist at putting youth at risk. Okay.
Okay, that helps me start.
Sure.
That's true. The downsizing of the Department of Youth Services is remarkable. I think there were more than 2,000 kids locked down in DYS facilities before this lawsuit. Now there's wavering between 600 and 700, and, you know, there's been a reduction in the facilities. And that's remarkable, but it wasn't just done in a vacuum. Ohio had been thinking about its juvenile population sort of separate from the SH litigation, and it certainly became motivated and incorporated into the SH process. But the Ohio reclaim, and what was later become the targeted reclaim, truly is already a model that really needs to be studied and replicated in other states. And it really makes me sad to see Ohio being held up as an example, but only part of the story is being told. You know, in California, Texas, and Georgia, just in New York, right now, the debate is happening where these things are being discovered. You know, the whole notion of shifting kids out of the deep end or out of agencies such as the Department of Youth Services and keeping them in the counties. And that's really the optimal. That's what we know to work. It's better always to keep kids locally so that their families can benefit from their treatment, so that they can be kept at home, so they could the counties can utilize alternatives and address issues in the community through preventative measures. And, you know, that we know that to be the model, and that's what Ohio has done. Ohio has done that through the Reclaim program and Target Reclaim in a very thoughtful sophisticated way. In California, however, and Texas, you've seen similar, if not more dramatic, drops in population. However, the money didn't follow the kids to the county. And so what's happening is those kids who are in great need of services, of treatment, are getting it. And many of them are ending up in the adult system. And it's just not helpful. Ohio has avoided that. And, you know, I think those who are considering policy reform in other states, I mean, there's a battle cry nationwide to utilize incarceration less and less for juveniles and adults. But you got to do that in a, you know, in a thoughtful way. And the money has to follow the kids. And Ohio has created a model program that creates, you know, financial incentives for counties to keep their kids locally and to explore alternatives to detention, to invest in prevention. But they're not only encouraged to do it, but they get the resources from the state to do it. Texas has merged the deep end system, the Texas Youth Commission, with juvenile probations, and therefore will evolve into more kids staying in the counties. But the investment wasn't made up front, and so I'm just really concerned about where a lot of those kids will end up. And the counties with greater resources, such as Houston, Dallas, Austin, or San Antonio, those counties might be able to do the right thing for these kids. But in the rural areas that just don't have the resources, I'm afraid that those kids are going to end up in adult jails, and there will be no oversight and no treatment, and things will just be far worse for many of those kids.
Okay, well, we do have some questions coming in, but before I start addressing them, I want to also give you the opportunity to talk about some of the areas that you found in your report that still need work and are some priorities. I think a few of them were around mental health and the continued use of seclusion.
Right. Yeah, and those things are not unconnected. Unfortunately, juvenile justice systems have become the dumping ground for youth with mental health illnesses, and this is not unique to Ohio by any means. Over the past decade, we've seen a steady decrease in community-based funding for mental health treatment for adults and for youth, and the result has been a dramatic increase of youth and adults with significant mental health illnesses going into correctional environments, which are the exact worst place for them to be. It is inappropriate placement for them, and these systems aren't designed to provide the treatment that those individuals need. That's not, Ohio Department of Youth Services doesn't get to pick and choose the kids who come to them. They have to do the best that they can with the limited resources they have with those kids. There is a state task force that was formed through legislation last session in Ohio that is tasked with looking at these issues and coming up with solutions. That's going to be critical for the Department of Youth Services, that task force really steps back and does a reevaluation and undoes some of the policy mistakes that have been made in that state, like others, over the past decade. You know, regionally based mental health treatment centers and community based mental health services need to be buffered by the state, and that's going to require some appropriations. And the Department of Youth Services needs to have an emergency valve, and the ability to discharge youth if they're due to their mental illness are not able to function in that population or to be truly and receive rehabilitation that the agency attempts to offer. That mental health, that's been, in my opinion, a very significant issue for the department, but again, that's going to require legislative action and for other agencies to step up and help attend to the needs of those kids. Another issue that I think needs to be addressed is you know, that's related to mental health is the process of competency determinations in the state. And I've met some of these kids, and I just don't understand how any judge found that kid competent to stand for you know, the process of adjudication in the case for whatever delinquent act they're accused of. So that, I know that there was legislative reform last session, and hopefully that will generate some relief for these kids and for the Department of Youth Services. Another issue that I found in Ohio is the handcuffs that the bargaining collective bargaining agreement puts on the Department of Youth Services in a couple of ways. It's astounding to me that I have, you know, I'm aware of a few cases where staff have, you know, been clearly proven to have committed egregious acts against youth, yet they're still working there today. The bargaining agreement places DYS managers in a very difficult position where they have to often rehire or disciplinary action is reduced by someone outside the agency, and the message is sent to staff that you essentially have a certain level of impunity. That does not help the agency officials who wish to reform the culture in that agency. Also, there's this process called pick-a-post that, you know, individuals on the basis of longevity, not merit, have the options of selecting a post that they prefer. And usually those decisions are based on what the shift of the day or, you know, an attempt to a desire to avoid working on the weekends. Well, that's fine, and I can appreciate that, but it should not be applied to specialized units. There are units such as, you know, specialized units that house kids with significant mental health problems. You know, the agency should be able to require that you have a certain education or experience or proven desire to work with that population or training specific to working with that population, because it takes a special individual to work appropriately and effectively with those youth. So that, you know, is, again, a problem that's outside of the hands of the agency that's going to be an obstacle to the agency and the state getting into full compliance with the stipulation.
Well, one of the questions we received was about special management units, so that's sort of a perfect segue there.
Yes.
Maybe you can actually explain a little bit more what they are, but the question was, is there anything that can be done to eliminate the need for them?
Yeah, well, that's a real good question, and I suspect asked by somebody who's kind of in the know on this matter, but that's one of the, I think, the core issues that the parties and the expert team are grappling with right now. SMU Special Management Units refers to SMUs. This has been an item of intense controversy before the litigation was brought, and since the litigation has been monitored. A special management unit is essentially like an administrative segregation unit where kids who are either commit very significant violent acts or are chronically violent end up in this unit and can stay for a considerable amount of time. The philosophy is to give them more treatment, more intensive services, but we have found, unfortunately, that often does not happen. And part of that is just for a failure of planning, but I think it also, again, has to do with the inability of the Department of Youth Services to specifically assign the appropriate staff to those units. Rather, those units are being picked by staff who want to work in those units for certain shifts because of convenience to themselves. But right now, we're undergoing an evaluation of what's, you know, the agency, I think about 6 months ago, reduced significantly the population that were in what was called an SMU or special management unit. They moved the SMU or to Scioto with the closure of the Ohio River Valley facility. The attention at that time was to intensify, increase, and reform the services available, and to reduce again the number of youth in that facility, and to expedite the process of those kids going through the program and reintegrating into the general population. That really hasn't happened since the closure, or the more kids were infused into that program, and it just doesn't appear to be working the way that I think the agency had hoped it was, but I think we're all looking closely at that right now, and we'll be doing what we can to enhance it. I think, you know, over time, hopefully, and the agency has stated that they're committed to eliminating those units or types of units altogether. That happened in Texas. Texas, when I was the ombudsman, had a similar program called the AMP, AMP, Anger Management Program, but it was abolished, and the sky did not fall, and I think eventually Department of Youth Services will get there as well.
Great. I want to remind our listeners that they can also call in and ask a question on air by dialing 347-994-1149 and pressing the number 1 on your telephone keypad. So, Will, I think all of our listeners are pretty informed about the case. So our next question is actually about one of the stipulations. And for people who are listening in who may be not as familiar about this, I want to point you to the website childrenslawky.org. There you'll find a copy of the stipulation, Will's most recent annual report, and also a fact sheet that goes back a few years about the reasons that the case was even filed in the first place. So the question is going to stipulation number 65, which pertains to safe living conditions. And so first, if you can give an explanation of what that would even mean in the context of a juvenile correctional facility, and that in your annual report, it appeared that two facilities were not in complete compliance with that stipulation. So what does that mean exactly as well?
It means a number of things. I mean, like, it would suggest safety on the units where the kids live. And that means, you know, the kid has a right to be safe from, you know, abuse from other kids and staff. You know, the kid has a right to live in a sanitary environment and all of those things. And I think safety, there is always a concern in these facilities, and is one of the fundamental issues with incarceration. There's been a lot of research on this, and when you put any people, adult or juvenile, in a confined space for a period of time, there will be acts of violence, and that is almost unavoidable. But it is the state's obligation to avoid that to the extent possible. And, you know, fault can be laid at the feet of the youth and to the state. And what this is an evaluation of the violence amongst youth and staff abuse of youth and youth abuse of staff. This looks at, you know, the use of force and investigate, you know, when there's an abuse of force, is it properly documented, investigated, and is discipline meted out? And it looks at, you know, the violence among youth or sexual abuse amongst the youth. One of the issues that I think is of critical concern with safety, I'll say that according to subject matter expert Steve Martin, the use of force and the control of the use of force has dramatically improved, and I think the agency is approaching substantial compliance across the board on that. There are still problems with violence, particularly among the youth, and most of that is driven by gang involvement. The agency has worked very hard to create and design an appropriate gang prevention and intervention program. It's called the Phoenix New Freedom Program. The agency has been training it and is in the process of implementing that program, and I think it will be a priority not only for the agency but for our monitoring this year. But there is a significant gang issue in Ohio that's actually unique compared to the other states that I've worked in. The gang issue in other states, for example, Texas, usually involves street gangs or youth who were involved with street gangs going into these institutions and sustaining their gang activity. Whereas in Ohio, kids who may have been formerly gang involved kind of leave that gang connection at the door and go in and associate with a institution-based gang. It's a unique phenomenon, but the motivations of a kid to associate with a gang, I think, are the same. But that's an issue that we've been concerned about and have met repeatedly and reported repeatedly on with the agency, and I believe, you know, under the leadership of Laura Dolan and others, that the new gang prevention intervention program will be implemented this year, and we'll see a direct reduction in safety concerns as a result of that.
Great. Other priorities you talked about in your report really have to do with education and also moving youth from the facilities back into the community. Can you expand on that a little bit?
Yeah. A lot of the I can say that over the past year, I've seen the reporting of subject matter expert in this area has, you know, the marks have increasingly gone up. There were issues with the quality of instruction. The state relies largely on this program called A1, which is a computer-based program where essentially kids sit in front of a computer and are told to learn. And there was, you know, in the beginning of the year, not a lot of instruction going along with that. I think now what we've seen is an increase of the integration of instruction with that A1 program, but a lot of that just depends on the individual commitment of a teacher. You know, we've also had some pretty significant concerns about the lack of availability of vocational opportunity, training opportunities for these kids, because, you know, that's key to reentry. I mean, I think that the research shows that there's really no greater indicator of the success of a kid reentering the community than the education and vocational education they receive while they're in institutions like DYS. I think there's been significant improvement, and more improvement needs to come. But maintaining the appropriate staffing levels is always difficult in these institutions. And also, you know, where you're dealing with kids who, you know, for the most part are significantly behind in grade level and education. On the other hand, this is a great opportunity to help them catch up, and many kids do. But education is always a struggle in these institutions, and again, that's not unique to Ohio. And I forgot what the other issue you asked about was.
The reentry, the release.
Reentry, yeah. Right. You know, the revocation levels in Ohio are lower than a lot of other states. But we've identified, you know, there needs to be a more of a connect, between the reentry plan of a kid when they enter the facility and what it's going to look for them when they get out of the facility. But in addition to education, a great indicator of success for youth when they get out of an institution like DUIS is what has happened back home, how prepared is the family and the community to deal with the kids when they come back home. And I have to say that I think that another way that Ohio has or will become a national model is what they've been doing regarding family integration. The Vera Institute, with support of the Public Welfare Foundation, have really come in and helped the agency develop a robust program whereby, you know, they engage the family in the youth treatment, but they also engage staff in the reality of a youth's life and history by educating the staff on where this kid's coming from. And that, you know, the reality of their community and home life becomes part of their treatment. I also really respect the fact that Ohio, through their work with Vera, has sort of expanded the notion of a family, and, you know, in a way that really, I would say, keeps it real. You know, family, you know, community, family is defined in modern society, particularly in urban environments, as more than just mom and dad. It's uncle, it's teacher, it's coach, it's choir leader, it's a number of things. And Ohio has recognized that and has developed that into their program. And, you know, that's again, a model that should be replicated in other systems around the nation.
Okay, now we are going to turn to a caller on air who I believe has a question about Reclaim. Gabriella, are you there? Do you have a question?
Yes. Can you hear me?
Yes, you're on.
Okay, great. Thanks for this important show, and I appreciate, Will, the comments you've shared so far. I'm wondering if you could speak a little bit about, you talked earlier, just taking back to an earlier topic, of the importance of Ohio as a national model in terms of what it's done with Reclaim. But more importantly, you also mentioned targeted Reclaim, and I would also add to that their behavioral health and juvenile justice initiative. And basically, to what degree is the lawsuit and your monitoring lawsuit promoting or helping the department to continue to encourage Reclaim programming to not just exist as an alternative, but to be effective, you know, to move those programs to be more effective and serving kids?
Well, that's great. And I do want to acknowledge this, is this, that the SH monitoring team cannot by any means take full credit or even much credit for the Reclaim and the targeted Reclaim efforts. Certainly Shay Bilcheck, who is at Georgetown University and the former director of the Office on Juvenile Justice and Delinquency Prevention, gets a lot of the credit, but he was involved with community stakeholders, judges, probation chiefs, and the Department of Youth Services for, I think, almost 9 years in designing the Reclaim program. So that predates, you know, the settlement agreement. I think that through this monitoring process, we've continued to support the DYS and community leaders' efforts in this regard. And, you know, Shay meets quarterly with the stakeholders who are involved with the institution of Reclaim and targeted Reclaim, and shares information and encouragement and makes sure that the resources are getting to where they need to be. I know that there's a meeting of that group coming up, I think, the first week of March. So that effort will continue. I'm not sure if I've addressed your comment or question, but please follow up if you need to.
Yeah, well, I think that what I really meant to say is that, yes, the targeted Reclaim in the BHJJ has been really successful. And you're just talking about other states like California and Texas who need to build a local capacity, which Ohio has really done. But what I think is also really important to point out is that Ohio is not just building a local capacity, but it's now trying, even beyond targeted Reclaim and BHJJ, it's trying to help encourage all the courts who have these programs, and there are hundreds of them around the state that aren't part of targeted Reclaim or BHJJ, to move them to more evidence-based, kind of research-supported, effective, basically, programs. So it's not
That's
just
right.
your local mom-and-pop shop, you know, kind of thing.
That's right, and that's critical, and that's exactly the conversation that is not happening in California, Texas, or Georgia. And it's, I think it's a critical piece missing in those other states.
Yeah.
And I hope that there'll be a way for the people involved in Ohio to get on the road and go and preach their methods to the other states, because I just, you know, worry very much about, you know, we can agree or disagree about the appropriate placement of any of these youth into a place like DYS or California Youth Authority or the Texas Youth Commission, but the fact of the matter is these kids need help, you know, for the most part. Maybe not all of them, but they do need help. And just by saying you're not going to DYS or CYA or TYC doesn't address that fact. And by just dumping them and leaving them in the counties doesn't solve anybody's problems. And, you know, unless that conversation is had, then these kids are destined to enter the system or possibly the adult system or worse.
Thank you, Gabriella, for your question. All right, we have a few more questions coming in, and we have about 15 minutes left, and I know you have some final thoughts you also want to share. We had a question about the release authority, and perhaps you can even explain what that is. But someone wants to know what changes have occurred with release authority, and specifically what's being done to ensure that children are not being held years beyond their minimum commitment.
Okay, yeah, the release authority is it's kind of like a parole board. It's an entity that's established that creates sort of a separate quasi-independent board that reviews release decisions and makes release decisions. And that's important historically in other states, and, you know, and to this day, sometimes release authority decisions are made at the local level, and often those can be made in arbitrary or punitive ways that aren't relevant to, you know, thoughtful rehabilitative goals. Ohio, you know, is operating with the release authority, and on the SH monitoring team, subject matter Vince Nathan has written, I think now, 3 reports that identify problems that are mostly related to confusion and misinterpretations of what the stipulation requires. But a lot of improvement has been made, and right now we are in the process of a dispute resolution with the state, which is sort of a formal process that was established in the stipulation. So I don't think it'd be appropriate to comment too much on the details of the negotiations that we're having right now. But, you know, there's been some problems identified by Vince Nathan, the subject matter expert. The Department of Youth Services has worked closely with us to address those problems, acknowledge the problems or refute them if they must. And we're in the process right now, working with the Attorney General's office and the Department of Youth Services to address and remedy those problems. And, you know, I hope within the next week we should have that all resolved, and we'll be able to report more details on that then.
Okay, thank you. Our next question, you shared that, well, maybe the state it's more than 25% compliance now, maybe 30, whatever the number is. But with this last push, maybe another year, what is the monitoring going to look like to help the state come into full compliance?
Well, we're working that out right now. You know, there's been some research on this phenomenon called monitoring fatigue, and I can see it. It is evident right now, and it's an understandable thing. You know, at some point, agencies get tired of being monitored. I think all of us would, in our own personal lives as well as our professional lives. And sometimes the agency feels like, you know, we know what we need to do, and just leave us alone and do it. But, you know, unfortunately, there is this litigation. There is a stipulation. There's a federal court observing the implementation of an agreed order, and so we have to be here and we have to act as the eyes and ears of the court until compliance is met. We are trying in many ways to sort of streamline our efforts to reduce the amount of time that it takes the agency to comply with our requests for data and documentation. We're doing whatever we can to reduce the burden that monitoring creates on the agency. But make no mistake, we have an obligation to the court and to the youth and to the public of Ohio. And we're gonna you know, achieve that, but we're gonna do everything that we can to streamline those efforts. And so, like I said, so that we can be, you know, in compliance with the agency at the end of this stipulated agreement. I mean, that's the goal, to get this done right and to get it done right on time.
So, what other hopes do you have for Ohio? You talked about the family engagement process as becoming a model for the country. Do you see, based on your experiences in other states, what opportunities are coming out of Ohio?
Well, you know, if I think, I mean, I tip my hat to the authors of this stipulated agreement. It is, you know, the most thorough agreement, you know, and a roadmap that I've seen in any litigation. And I can tell you, you know, I was involved in Texas with the reforms there. The reforms in Texas were initiated through legislation and not through judicial action. We passed Senate Bill 103 that was a massive legislative reform of the juvenile justice system in Texas, and that was based nearly in most instances word for word on the stipulation. So I think the stipulation itself can act as a roadmap to other states who wish to reform, and it has been done. It was used that way in Texas. But I think that when this agency gets to full compliance and can kind of lean back a little bit, I would hope that, you know, some of the leadership in the agency are able to go around the country and talk to other agencies about how they got to this point. Because, again, if the stipulation is implemented fully in a sustainable way, you know, Ohio will be the model for juvenile justice in the nation. We all talk about Missouri as the model, and Missouri is an extraordinary system, and a lot of the reclaim efforts, you know, are based on what Missouri has done. But Missouri isn't the only model and may not be the best model for some states. And I think, you know, larger states such as Texas and Colorado and California should really take a look at what's going on in Ohio. This is my opinion.
Okay, and maybe our last question from our listeners. Is there anything that the public can do in Ohio to help sort of keep an eye on what's happening with youth in the systems and help fuel more reform?
That's a great question. And that's, you know, it's really important because, you know, frankly, I think, and I've talked to, there's a really energized, sophisticated, and bright juvenile justice community in the state of Ohio, and that are poised to go take it to the next level. And they ask me often what, you know, should be their priorities. And some have come to me and I've said, you know, I really think that conditions of confinement and DYS are pretty well covered. You know, you've got an agency committed to reform. You've got the best possible federal judge watching. You've got an immense team of, you know, well-regarded experts across the country all looking at conditions of confinement. The agency needs help, and that is help in going to the legislature, going to community leaders locally, and getting the resources they need to create viable alternatives to the Department of Youth Services. And I think the most important thing that citizens or juvenile justice activists in Ohio could be doing right now is following this mental health state task force and making sure that they produce meaningful recommendations and that those recommendations are acted upon and appropriately funded by the legislature in the next legislative session.
Great. And do you have any other final thoughts you want to share, sort of about the status of the case or anything else at this point that you want us to be aware of?
No, I think that just with regard to the case, you know, there's, you know, 25% plus compliance. You know, every day the agency ticks off another goal, and we get closer and closer. But at some point, the monitoring team will leave. At some point, people at the agency will leave. But the facilities and the kids will still be coming through there. So I think it's important to think, you know, post-SH versus Reed realities. And, you know, there are some state entities such as the CIIC, the legislative committee that has oversight authority on these facilities. You've got a really strong public defender's office there. There's a independent legal assistance program that will need continued support through the legislature and through the public. Their needs, you know, is to the, you know, I, as I'll continue to say, have the utmost respect and confidence in the leadership and staff at the Department of Youth Services. But independent oversight is always fundamental in this arena, and those agencies need to continue to exist and to have adequate funding and authority to continue monitoring after the SH versus Stickgrass monitoring team is gone.
Well, thank you so much for taking the time to be with us today. I really appreciate it, and perhaps next year you'll be on to tell us about more of the progress that we've made in Ohio. Our next episode will focus on girls in the juvenile justice system and the role of gender-specific prevention and intervention. Our guests will be from the National Council on Crime and Delinquency Center for Girls and Young Women, and they will discuss the findings of a national needs assessment that the center conducted, including hearing from girls and their families. To stay informed about this and other upcoming shows, you can follow us here at Blog Talk Radio or visit the Children's Law Center's website at www.childrenslawky.org. Take care and see you next time on Spotlight on Youth. Thank you again, Will, very much.
Thank you.